Leaving only a handful of isolated men in the ring around the fort, he shifted the rest of us, taking every precaution, so that the enemy would believe they were still surrounded by a strong force. In this way, he was able to mass 500 men and send them all at once against the enemy's weakest point, a V-shaped trench held by 40 men armed with rifles and one machine gun. At his order, 500 men rushed the enemy position, attacking with grenade throwers. The enemy reeled under the force of this blow, and was unable to maintain an accurate fire. 7 or 8 of our men fell during this assault, but the maneuver was so magnificent that for the moment no one paid much attention to them. I was part of the second wave, 2 others followed us. When we reached the enemy position, the job was already done. Some 40 partisans had tried to resist, but our rain of grenades annihilated 2/3 of them. The remainder had died on the bayonets of the first Germans to reach the fortress. We followed hard on their heels. Another wave was right behind us. The underbrush rang with hideous screams, and smelled of powder and smoke and blood. I saw more partisans pouring from their log fort, and firing point blank at our men, who were exhilarated by the success of our action. In the general confusion, I opened fire along with everyone else. A tall Russian fired at me 3 times without hitting me, although I made no effort to dodge him. Then he rushed at me, shouting and waving his gun, holding the butt in the air. 2 of our men joined me and fired at the Russian. He fell and tried to reload his gun, but we jumped him immediately, battering him with our butts. He died under our blows. At the foot of the blockhouse, a desperate hand-to-hand struggle was in progress. Something exploded in the midst of the fighting, sending shattered fragments of German and partisan bodies flying through the air. Other men ran up to continue the fighting, surrounded by the dead and dying. Cries and curses mingled with the sharp crack of rifle fire. A moment later, we were in the thick of the fighting. One of the fellows with me had his arm broken by an exploding mine. Pressed against the wooden wall, men were fighting hand to hand with knives, shovels, feet, and stones. An obfuscator had just hit a Russian in the face with his shovel, opening a hideous gash. The wounded man fell writhing to the ground. Kellerman was firing in short bursts at the partisans hidden behind the 2 howitzers which had given us so much trouble. Many Russians got away, at least half of them. Those who couldn't added to the numbers of the dead. We collected all the stray guns and reserves of food, destroyed the howitzers, which we couldn't take with us, and buried 70 of our men. Then we left the place, carrying out the wounded on stretchers made of branches. In the evening we arrived at a kolkhoz, where we drank everything we could get hold of, trying to blot out the memory of a hideous day. Spring in the Ukraine, endless days of almost unbroken light. A luminous darkness fell toward 11 at night, to yield to a pink dawn a few hours later. The weather was perfect, a warm, reviving wind, before the crushing heat of summer. Unfortunately, although the season made us dream of peace, the monster of war was finally able to emerge from the paralysis of winter and the thaw. The pale blue sky belonged to the Russians, whose air power had grown enormously. The Luftwaffe, whose numbers had been seriously reduced by the necessity of defending German cities and dealing with the increasing demands of the Western Front, flew daily sorties which amounted to suicide flights against overwhelming enemy strength on the ground and in the air. Our few victories were the product of absolute heroism. The sky and the front belonged to the enemy. The rear areas were contested by 2 nearly equal opponents, the German army and the partisans. We continually sent out patrols. Almost every sortie produced a clash. Every hill and hedge and cottage held a mine, or hidden ambush. We had almost no vehicles of any kind, no gas, and no spare parts. We were also not receiving any fresh supplies. The odd, ill-assorted convoys still pressing through continuous air attacks were not destined for us but for the faltering, collapsing front. When they arrived in the forward zone, they were able to find the correct units only by accident. More often than not, their cargoes were absorbed by the hordes of starving men retreating under a deluge of fire. We ourselves received at the greatest risk about a tenth of what we needed. We were obliged to live off the local inhabitants, who were very hard-pressed themselves and more than reluctant in their attitude toward us. The problem of food had become extremely serious. As it was spring, there were still very few fruits, and hunting was more dangerous for us than for the game. A small hamlet sheltered what remained of our three companies. Between operations, men slept almost naked on the ground. "Those who sleep dine," says the proverb. For us, it was vitally important that this become the reality. When planes came over, everyone took cover, and when they were gone, we laid our bony bodies out in the sun again. This helped to heal our winter louse bites. Half asleep, with our eyes half closed, we stared into the sky, apparently thinking of nothing. What was the use? We seemed to have broken completely with the past. Memories of peace floated up like fragments of books we might have read. The war had taught us to appreciate every minuscule good. Today, the sun took the place of our goulash and Worston millet, and the mail which no longer came. We lay stretched on the Ukrainian soil, apparently calm and at peace. Tomorrow, perhaps, some food would arrive and perhaps some gas, and some spare parts. Perhaps even some melee letter from Paula. But perhaps, too, there would only be ourselves and the earth and the sky and the sun. What was the use of thinking about it? One day, our radio crackled out an SOS from a territorial post on the Romanian frontier. It was surrounded by a band of partisans. In the eyes of the Wehrmacht, we were still officially considered part of a motorized unit standing by, and therefore available. In consequence, we were always moving, and had to be ready to leave at a moment's notice for points anywhere within our radius of 150 miles. The post calling us was some 100 miles away, and had appealed to us because its officers had been told that in emergencies they could rely on our mobility. In fact, we had four trucks in bad condition, a small civilian van, a sidecar, and the CO's Steiner. Wesrida tore his hair and cursed. As quickly as possible, 100 of us left to answer the SOS. We took along as many automatic weapons as we could to make up for our small number. Each truck carried two Spandaus ready to fire. Above all else, we feared planes. We drove as quickly as we could along the terrible Russian roads, raising a thick cloud of dust. About 30 miles from our starting point, we hurtled through a village which could have belonged to prehistory. The inhabitants ran as fast as they could to get out of our way. We were bristling with weapons and black with dust, and we must have looked far from reassuring. As we left the village, a group of terrified residents scattered ahead of us. The Steiner went through, and then the first truck, which crushed a dog. The second truck bumped a black pig, which ran out from nowhere and threw itself under the wheels. I was in the third truck, and saw the whole sequence: the sudden braking ahead, the shrieking villagers running to the side of the road, the screaming pig, dragging itself through the dust. Five or six lads jumped off the truck to chase the pig, trying to kill it as it squealed in agony. Finally, they stabbed it with their bayonets. It was still kicking, spattering its executioners with blood, as they tied its feet with belts and ropes, and hung its 150 pounds from the tailgate of their truck. Then we started off again, to catch up with the others, leaving the village in a squeal of gears. The pig too was soon covered with dust, which mingled with its streaming blood. We no longer objected to details like that. For those who survived, there would be fresh meat this evening. Sieg Heil. We were now driving through a strange landscape of smooth black hills, almost like enormous boulders, scattered with a few stunted trees. Wherever the ground was broken, the soil was black and seemed as hard as stone. I wished that I knew something of geology. Our route took us through this curious terrain for about 15 miles. We had just left that strange district when a group of planes was reported. One of our spotters confirmed that he had seen them through the treetops, slightly to our left. Our trucks pulled over to the side of the road, where they were screened by leaves. Wesridow stared at the sky through his field glasses, but couldn't see anything. It seemed wise to wait for a few minutes. The Lancer in the third truck put the time to good account, slitting open the pig and getting rid of its guts with lightning speed. As the job wasn't quite finished when we started out again, they finished it on the back of the truck. A few miles farther on, as we bumped through a chaotic landscape, two planes came over very low. We shouted at the drivers, who jammed on the brakes. There were no thick trees anywhere near us. As the planes passed directly overhead, we were all gripped by an insane, helpless panic. Some men wet their pants. As the planes vanished into the distance, we lifted our heads and saw two ME-109FS, which must have been the survivors of some squadron. No one thought of cheering the Luftwaffe, we had all been too afraid. Toward 4, we approached the zone of operations. Our trucks were following a winding track through mountainous country, driving very slowly for fear of ambush. Wesrid Aussteiner was in the lead. Two observers, hunched on the hood, kept their eyes riveted on the dust along the way, and on the heights surrounding us. Nothing we could see was in any way reassuring. Suddenly, we were looking down into an open valley. We stopped, cutting off our engines, and immediately heard the distant sound of machine guns. Beyond all doubt, we had arrived. In the distance, through the heat haze, we could see what looked like a village. We kept the trucks 100 yards apart, and maintained a moderate speed, as the men clung onto the outside of the railings. Once again our stomachs clenched at the approach of danger, and we wondered when we would begin to be adult men. Naturally, the enemy knew we were coming. The first truck suddenly saw the commander's Steiner driving backward at breakneck speed from a turn in the road. The vehicle was rolling down a slope when a sharp explosion burst on the track some 10 yards ahead of it. Everyone plunged to the ground, and the trucks took whatever shelter they could. A second explosion tore a hole in the road, lifting a large cloud of dust. They were plastering us with shells from a 37mm gun. Then a burst of machine gun fire riddled the first truck. Luckily, everyone was already out. The driver must have watched in a cold sweat. The enemy was hidden by the undulations of the country, and was very hard to see. Nonetheless, the men in the Steiner knew they'd been lucky. It was miraculous that the 37mm gun hidden behind the T's to the right of the turning hadn't opened fire the moment the Steiner appeared. The partisans had felled a tree across the road, right after the turn. We set up two light mortars, and shelled the enemy gun, which soon fell silent. Probably amateurs, Wesridar remarked. We deployed a dozen FMS, which made movement very difficult for the partisans firing from the mountainside. Our group slid through the brush and climbed the first rocky outcrops, while our mortars rained a hail of projectiles, more terrifying than destructive, onto any point that seemed to harbor opposition. We had just uncovered an enemy post real Johnny come lately giving Fritz a hard time in order to reap a reward from their grateful country. What bastards, muttered Princess Melons, coming to shoot at us just for the bell of it. We'll fix them. Our group attacked the partisans with grenade throwers. In that enclosed bowl of hills, the explosions made an overwhelming noise. Then someone raked the edges of the enemy ambush with a spandau, which we recognized by the sound of its fire. After two more grenades, the apprentice sharpshooters were ready to give up. A figure ran out, attempting a desperate flight. He was quickly cut down by the spandau. What a bastard! Prince shouted. It's horrible to shoot down idiots like that. Why can't they stay home and wait until the war ends, for the love of God? If I was in their shoes, no one could twist my arm and you'd be the same, wouldn't you, Sager? Home. The thought went to my head like a gulp of wine. Home, to wait for the war to end. Yes, I said finally. And now we have to shoot them, he said. It's disgusting. We could hear plaintive cries from the enemy entrenchment. To our left, spandaus and grenade throwers were destroying the tranquility of the spring. Suddenly, one of the Russian boys in an excess of zeal stood up, exposing half his body, and raked us with a burst of machine gun fire. His loose, approximate fire wounded one of our men in the right hand, and then another, undoubtedly on the ricochet, in the calf. The Russian was shot down by our Spandau, while our wounded man began to groan in a shaded corner. God damn it. Someone shouted. Will you stop this bullshit? Two figures climbed from the partisan position and, without any apparent hurry, began to run. Our FM sent them rolling in the dust too. Did you see that? Smellens said to the gunner. You just got a girl. A girl? Are you sure? If women are getting mixed up in this mess now, that's the last straw. A few minutes later we counted the bodies of the partisans, six young people about our age. Among them were two pretty girls, bathed in blood and covered with a swarm of blue flies. We stared down at our victims, sickened by the sight. Why had they thrown themselves across the route of our misery? Their amateur barrier was quickly dismantled. We cleared the road, and marched to the village. The trucks followed slowly behind us. Had the enemy been misinformed? Had they received exaggerated estimates of our minuscule capacity? Were they afraid? Whatever the reason, they abandoned their grip on the post which was almost theirs, and came out to meet us. The sun was shining brightly on the narrow, dusty road. At the head of the column, our men were in contact with the enemy, who had taken refuge in the town cemetery. It was a typical Russian cemetery, blue and gold and white, with no suggestion of sadness about it. The day was perfect, the spring of late June turning into summer. We could almost have been fighting for a lark. Each plume of smoke was immediately carried away by a gentle breeze. We would certainly have been satisfied by a light exchange of fire, but our commander saw things differently. We couldn't let the enemy think we were too weak to attack. So our grenade throwers and light mortars destroyed the blue cemetery. Two groups chased the partisans out, and occupied the cemetery gardens. The partisans had taken refuge in a nearby wooden building where the crops were stored. On the door, the enemy had just daubed the Marxist slogan, "Workers of the World, Unite." This hasty scrawl, with dripping letters, gave a tearful impression of Marxist beliefs. To dispose as quickly as possible of this flimsy, improvised fortress, we loaded the Spandau with explosive incendiary bullets. The thatched roof caught on fire almost at once. The enemy, who were defending themselves with automatic weapons, did not spare their fire. A salvo of mortar shells knocked the roof into the building, and the partisans had to abandon an untenable position. Our two groups ran toward the burning building to harass the Russians as they fled. An old bearded man was leaning against a pile of stones, shouting curses at us. His right hand rested on the head of a dead comrade who lay on the ground beside him. The old man was wounded himself, and his clothes were torn and burned. We walked past him at a distance of no more than 3 yards. The sight of our guns didn't silence him. He shook his fist at us, and cursed us. We all saw him through the smoke and sparks of the burning barn, but no one thought of shooting him. He showered maledictions at us until the collapse of the building buried him. A column of sparks rose into the azure sky. The first elements of our group were already in the village streets, firing on anything that moved. The last of the partisans were running toward the mountains. For a moment, they were directly exposed to our fire, and we shot down 20 of them on the dusty road and among the junipers on the hillside. The Spandau, which had been fitted with a special magazine, took a horrible toll of the fleeing groups of partisans. Then we stopped firing, and the men from the German post came out and joined us. Many of them were wounded, and 12 were dead. We gave the wounded first aid, and drove the local residents from their huts. Fires were spreading everywhere, and had to be put out. Men, women, and children joined us in fighting the flames. It took almost an hour to put the fires out. Then everyone, ourselves included, dragged the bodies of the dead to a central point. Women screamed and cried as they recognized a husband or son or lover. It looked as if most of the partisans had lived in this place. Soon, however, the tears and sobs became threats and curses. We collected our own dead and wounded with the usual mute sentiment established by habit. The day was so beautiful it was hard to believe that any of this was really serious. Our eyes, disillusioned by so much accumulated fear and anxiety, no longer distinguished the tragedies of any particular moment. Hals was staring at the magnificent mountain scenery, as he carried along a comrade whose tunic was blotched with brown stains. The birds had regained their sense of spring joy and were flying once again through the blue sky, which was faintly marked by smoke from the smoldering fires. For us, in the Eastern armies, this joyousness of nature almost excused what had just happened. After the mud and the cold, we were like wild animals, overjoyed by the spring sun, and the knowledge that shelter for the night was no longer a serious problem. We deplored what had just happened as a disturbance of the peace and quiet we so much appreciated. The villagers were still caught in a crisis of tearful despair, and insults which were comprehensible simply by their tone shook our sense of well-being. Someone threw a stone, which hit one of our wounded men in the face. Two lancers spun around, brandishing their machine guns. "Break it up, you pigs, or we'll drill you full of holes." But the shouted curses kept right on. We were ringed by faces, especially feminine faces, distorted by rage, spitting and cursing, and by shaking fists. Suddenly, six planes flying wing to wing appeared in that marvelous sky, six Soviet fighters, looking for one of our convoys. This sign heartened the Russians, who shouted, "Ara Stalin," and pointed at the planes, which blindly continued their search. We could see such hatred on all these faces that we shivered, despite the fine spring day. We were all thinking of our tortured, mutilated comrades, murdered by men who were mixing themselves into a fight that had left them on the sidelines. We remembered once again the tragic deaths at the territorial posts all along our line of retreat during the winter, faces smashed open with axes, so that the gold teeth could be pulled out. The hideous agony of wounded men tied with their heads inside the gaping bellies of dead comrades, amputated genitals, a section, whom we had found tied up and naked, on a day when the temperature had dropped to 30 degrees below zero, with their feet thrust into a drinking trough which had frozen solid, and the faces of tortured men under the dark winter sky. With dry mouths, we listened to the mounting rage of these peasants, who were now paying a price they could have avoided for all time. If anyone had ordered us to fire, we would have obeyed without hesitation. I could see the gun shaking in the filthy, nervous hands of the man nearest me. A little way off, another of our men was no longer able to control the trembling of his face muscles. We had all stopped working, and our anger was rising like a storm. A tall, slim figure strode between the two groups. We saw that it was Wezridal, and that he was white with fury. He stopped 5 yards from the Russians, and threw them a look so terrible that silence fell at once. He had learned Russian during the long course of the campaign. He told the villagers to bury their dead with the same silence and respect he required of his troops. He said that the war would soon be over for them, and that they should wait for the end, keeping to the sidelines. He said that he had never imagined the war would bring him to shoot civilians, who had been misled into arming by false propaganda, and excused himself for what he had been forced to do. Then his voice became as hard as death. He said that he would not tolerate any further hostile manifestations, that he intended to return to camp with all his men still alive, and that the entire village would be held responsible if he did not. Wezridal's words had the effect of a soothing balm. Everything returned to a state of unexpected order. The dead were buried and sobs were stifled. We found enough gas for our return in the stores of the outpost. The men there entertained us with a few bottles they had put aside several months before. Then we returned to the road, leaving 8 wounded men behind at the post, where the medical service would pick them up the next day. 6 others failed to answer the roll call, and remained in the Ukrainian soil forever. "Not so crowded this time," someone said. We acquiesced without speaking. Our eyes lingered on the village disappearing behind clouds of dust raised by the trucks. The beautiful spring light glowed all around our blackened, steel-capped faces, which seemed irrevocably cut off from the season. Our awareness of everything was similarly split. Our thoughts, like our eyes, couldn't settle on anything that seemed definite, or restful, and a sense of well-being had no place in the convoy. The whirling dust hid the bursting spring. All we could see were the trucks, and the grotesque, dangling cadaver of the pig, covered with blood and flies. The trucks lurched along the narrow mountain road, whose illogical course might have been traced by some wandering goat. Obstacles like stone outcrops were included without modification, and natural, shaded ridges were avoided. Sometimes the track plunged into the bed of an unexpected stream, or through a temporary pond. At other times, we crossed deserts of dust, where the dryness seemed eternal. The trucks slowly pursued the twists and turns, carrying us along, penned between the rattling railings. We seemed to be wandering endlessly toward new horizons on which we never had time to gaze, through an oversized, over-intense spring which would not allow us to forget that we were at war. Our expressionless faces stared at the spring with the unhappiness of paupers staring into a shop window decorated for Christmas. We too wanted the war to stop and dreamed of peace, like the seriously ill for whom the first sight of spring buds kindles a spark of life. But the fighting didn't stop. There was never more than a semblance of peace, and always someone to fan the flames of war. These people on both sides perhaps had perfectly good reasons for what they did. On that day, one of them crossed the road as we climbed up the long slope. He had seen us coming, and quickly, perhaps inside of 10 minutes, laid his trap, hiding it in one of the dozens of potholes that pitted the surface. Then he hid, perhaps waiting to see what happened. Perhaps he too saw the yellow flash that tore apart our lead car. As always, there was a loud noise and a great deal of smoke climbing in black plumes toward the desperately smiling sky. 6 blood-stained men were slowly dying in the shadows of those plumes. The front of the Steiner was gone. The rest of the machine was knocked over onto its side. A few men pulled the victims from the flaming wreckage, while the rest assumed a defensive position. We laid Wesrida and the 5 other occupants of the car against the bank of red earth. 2 of them were already dead. Another had a leg torn open in several places by metal fragments. His thigh looked like a Melville pastry. Wesrida was covered with wounds, and his body seemed to be broken by multiple fractures. We did everything we could for him. The whole company thought of him as a friend. With everyone helping, we managed to bring him back to consciousness. Unlike everyone else we had watched, our captain did not have a face twisted by the revulsion or agony of death. His swollen face even managed to smile. We thought we had saved him. In a very weak voice he spoke to us of our collective adventure, stressing our unity, which must hold in the face of everything to come. He pointed to one of his pockets, from which Feldwell Sperlovsky pulled an envelope, undoubtedly addressed to his family. After that, for nearly a minute, we watched our chief die. Our faces, used to such spectacles, remained impassive. But the silence was terrible. We were able to save 2 of the men from the car, loading them carefully onto the vehicles which remained. Lieutenant Wallace took command, and organized a decent burial for our venerated leader. We walked past his grave one by one, saluting. We felt that we had just lost the man on whom the well-being of the whole company depended. We felt abandoned. That night we returned to the isolated village where our comrades were anxiously waiting for our return. The announcement of our commander's death provoked stupefied consternation. We were all in danger of death, but the annihilation of Wesrida seemed as impossible to us as life without their parents seems to small children. We were prepared for every other death, but no one was ready to concede that fate for our leader. Guard duty that night seemed more uncertain than before. Our 3 companies seemed more vulnerable than ever. We all turned toward a source of strength which remained silent. Who would our new leader be? On whom would the destiny of our group depend? At the first light of dawn, after our radio message had reached headquarters, a DO-217 flew over, releasing a smoke signal. This told us that our 3 motorized companies should proceed quickly to a key position at the front, to the north of us. We were ordered to destroy our base and most of the village. Nothing should be left which would aid or shelter the enemy. As we had no incendiary material, we limited ourselves to burning the thatched roofs of the cottages. Then our motorized company left on foot, with our materiel loaded into the four ancient trucks we had left.